Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded April 19th, 2023. Well, last week, Russia placed sanctions on more than 300 Canadians, barring the mostly government apparatchiks and media personalities' access to the country. It was, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, in hopes of, quote, encouraging those on the blacklist to change their behavior. Wide-ranging sanctions policies, including those Canada aims at Russia and eastern Ukraine, are now so common, Canada alone sanctioning a couple dozen countries and thousands of individuals and entities, they have threatened the world's economic system, or so argues the recently published book Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. John Philpott is a Montreal-based defense attorney in international criminal law, long active in Palestinian and African support organizations and campaigns to free political prisoners Mengwun Zhou and Alex Saab. Philpott is too an executive board member of Just Peace Advocates and the Sanctions Kill Coalition. John will be one of three speakers touring the Canadian book release starting tonight in Hamilton. John Philpott in the first half. And last week, France's Constitutional Court allowed some of President Emmanuel Macron's pension reforms, notably the most contentious one, an age eligibility rise. Organized labor there, who've rallied tens of thousands into the streets against the move over the last month, vows now to bring in a general strike on the workers' holiday, May Day. Meanwhile, Macron's address Monday was delivered to a cacophony of pots and pans, a regular casserolada banging outside the walls of power, where the workers chanted, "If Macron won't listen to us, we won't listen to him." Dr. Pablo Uziel is a postdoc at the Université du Québec à Montréal, whose area of study is the European Union, political, legal, and economic integration from above and below, and settler colonialism and Canadian society. Pablo Uziel and we, Emmanuel, Paris is burning in the second half. But first, John Philpott and sanctions, the hegemon's desperate bid to hold back the tides of change. Welcome back to the program, John.
It's nice to be with you.
Well, John, to begin with now, who's behind this book, Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy?
I can make a joke. The USA is and the Europe is are primarily behind it because they caused they're implementing sanctions, and therefore people have to resist. And I think your question is more related is who is working on this resistance? And so there's a the resistance to sanctions is a growing issue. With respect to this book, there's a group which was formed in the USA and has incorporated Canadians also recent in the last year or two called Sanctions Kill, which is an umbrella group of organizations in the USA and Canada who have been studying sanctions and holding webinars on sanctions, particularly during the COVID period, where everything we did was almost webinars, as you know. And they've done a lot of work. We have a website called Sanctions Kill, and we meet every couple of weeks. And the major issue is to explain to the Western population, and elsewhere, of course, that sanctions are a form of warfare. And we know that when you have a hot war, like the war in Iraq, where they killed hundreds of thousands of people in 2003, it was preceded by sanctions, terrible sanctions, following the first war in Iraq. And the figures are that 500,000 children died because of the United States sanctions on Iraq. And Madeleine Albright said it was worth it. So this is an example in the recent history of the devastating effects of sanctions and the will by the U.S. government to impose terrible economic measures. The best term probably would be unilateral coercive measures. And they're imposing it on countries which do not fall into line. There's many motives and reasons for which the USA and on a secondary level the Europe imposes sanctions, but the purpose is to impose their point of view and in doing so reduce the people to servitude and in many cases extreme suffering. And I could explain in very simple terms the question of the legality. you don't have to be a lawyer. I'm a lawyer. You don't have to be a lawyer to understand. All you have to do is, jokingly I'm saying, use your brain a little bit and look at a bit of history. The United Nations Charter, which is really the rules-based order which should govern international relations, has a fundamental principle, is the sovereign equality of nations. And you cannot intervene in the internal affairs of another country, which means that, and I'm now tongue-in-cheek saying, Algeria, for example, Algeria is not relevant to this, cannot intervene in the internal affairs of the United States and say, you, United States, Biden or Trump, you, if you don't abolish all racism, we will impose sanctions on you, and you cannot do business, and you will, you cannot use your banks, our banks, to do business. Now, this is obviously a joke because Algeria doesn't have that power, but it would come down to that. Algeria could say to the U.S., you cannot, if you don't abolish racism in your country, you cannot do business with our banks, and our banks control the world. Now, when you go back to the reality of it, one of the most important sanctions systems used in our recent lives is the embargo against Cuba, which has been in force, is it not 62 years? The Cuba has been under U.S. sanctions.
Well, of course, maybe not everybody, but people of a certain vintage may remember the infamous Leslie Stahl 60 Minutes interview with Madeleine, the late Madeleine Albright, where she was asked point blank in a moment of media clarity about the sanctions policy. We hardly ever hear about it otherwise, but sanctions are much older than that in the American context, going back to before the Second War. The Russians right now say, well, they were provoked into acting to protect the people of the eastern portion of Ukraine. The R2P, or the responsibility to protect, said to have emerged from Canada, is often invoked when it comes to sanctions and interfering in the affairs of other countries. Is there no situation, in your view, John, legally at least, where R2P or this intervention can be justified?
The Security Council, under the present legal system, Chapter 7, can impose sanctions on a country if there's a threat to peace. And it could be legitimate, and international relations, as we hope they would be, it is conceivable that the Security Council could impose sanctions on a country like, well, I don't want to give an example because I don't know of an example. However, in the real world, well, there was a slip. The sanctions on North Korea, which got through the Security Council, I don't agree with them. They have a certain legality because there was an abstention by Russia and China imposing some sanctions on North Korea because of its nuclear program. But I know that in sanctions kill, we don't agree with them, but the question of legality is not necessarily an issue. However, in the real world now, with Russia and China as members of the Security Council with the right of veto, it really comes down to, and we're talking, let's say, in 2020 or 2022 or 2023, as we are now, the sanctions are unilateral coercive measures imposed by the United States, and they really hurt. And for example, a country like Syria, the issues, they cannot obtain adequate medical materials. They cannot, the Syrian scientists cannot even attend scientific conferences because I understand that Zoom will not allow them to participate. And so they cannot reconstruct after 10 years of horrible war imposed by the jihadist, which actually are pro-U.S. destabilizing forces against Syria. And Syria is in very bad condition, and so they cannot rebuild their country because you cannot borrow, lend money. And any company which dares to do business with Syria can face the wrath of the United States, and banks can have incredibly large fines against them.
Would this though not be legal if if it wasn't America, say, because of their unique position in the world? And I'm not talking about exceptionalism necessarily, but if Canada, well, and Canada does follow suit, but if another country independently said, well, the practices of a neighbor or a distant country are so odious to them that they refuse to do business with them. Would that not be fair enough? I mean, without this, you know, impelling neighbors and friends to do the same thing, but to impel at least national entities to isolate them, as in the case of, say, South Africa or even a BDS-type movement.
That's another question, where countries are it's basically not governments, but it's local organizations which say, don't buy SodaStream.
This is boycott, divestment.
Yeah, and, boycott, divestment, sanctions. But that's not...
But yeah, I don't want to confuse the issue. But yeah, but a nation state adopting a BDS strategy, say, yes. Not to confuse the issue. Yes. Is there not a legal ground? I mean, if a country has sovereignty, certainly it would have sovereignty just to say, well, we don't like what you're doing and we're not going to have anything to do with you.
Of course, they can do that. But when the United States does that to impose its control on a country of the generally of a global south, it's now changing, of course. It becomes an arm, a form of war, which is illegal. And there's been a lot of there's many examples. For example, what they have done to Venezuela is they have imposed draconian sanctions on many parts of Venezuela's life: banking, getting spare parts for the oil industry, preventing Venezuela from exporting its oil, and it's led to a terrible degradation in the life, the salary, the income of Venezuela. The airports are empty. The hospitals do not have enough medical supplies. And it's a conscious aim by the United States to reduce the living standards of Venezuela in order to force a regime change. And these are unilateral coercive measures. And what we in Sanctions Kill are trying to explain to, for example, in the U.S. and Canada, because Canada is also against Venezuela, is that these are crimes, and Venezuela has pointed out the illegality of this, and they've talked about the massive suffering, which is the suffering in Venezuela is the equivalent to the suffering required for to be called a crime against humanity. So they have made a complaint to the International Criminal Court, which seems to be put on a shelf somewhere and is not advancing very successfully. We recently saw, for one thing, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, who I actually know because of I'm a defense lawyer in different international courts, has still trying to maintain criminal charges, investigations against Venezuela for violations of electoral laws and preventing people from participating in elections.
Well, indifferent might have been a Freudian slip of the tongue there, because America has in turn ignored, not signed on to recognize the International Court, and threatened and sanctioned members of the court itself.
For sure.
Is this Elena Doohan you're talking about, the UN Special
Rapporteur? No, Elena Doohan wrote the reports about the suffering in Venezuela and in Zimbabwe, for example. But I guess the International Criminal Court, I was going to make a joke about them, because, well, jokes are painful, but they show the real reality is that with respect to Ukraine, they are running to Ukraine to try and impose, to lay charges against Russia. And with such urgency and such a desire to punish the political enemies of the West, obviously, I won't even comment on the absurd nature of the charges against Mr. Putin, but I'm showing the double standard of the International Criminal Court, and I guess I'm sort of suggesting that any solution to the issue of sanctions will not be born of the International Criminal Court. There's an interesting situation in Zimbabwe, for example. There's been terrible suffering and degradation of the economy of Zimbabwe for the last 20 years since Zimbabwe deigned to apply land reform against the former colonialists who still maintained much of the land after independence in 1980. And the southern African countries have had an international day of opposition to sanctions on the 25th of October every year in the southern part of Africa, which is an example of one of the ways of resisting sanctions. The resistance to sanctions is extremely important, and there are many ways to oppose sanctions. Here in the West, our job is to convince our governments to abandon the sanctions policy for all the many reasons that they are wrong.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking with John Philpott. John's a Montreal-based defense attorney in international criminal law, and he's been long active in Palestinian and African support organizations and campaigns to free political prisoners, Meng Wanzhou and Alex Saab, for example. Philpott is an executive board member of Just Peace Advocates and Sanctions Kill Coalition. And John will be one of three speakers touring the Canadian book release, the book that we're talking about today, Sanctions, a Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. John, I'll play devil's advocate here, as perhaps Hugo Chavez would say, Selfura. The sanctioners say that their goal, and you mentioned it earlier, sometimes it's stated explicitly, but it's understood, is to foment citizen uprisings and revolution and even civil war, all on the aims of regime change to a more pliable, perhaps, government in said country. But their defenders say, well, this is an alternative to outright war, and they're is a humanitarian case to be made that fewer people will be hurt. It will prevent civilian deaths that you would see in warfare. So, again, back to the responsibility to protect doctrine, loosely defined, that there is a standing, although they would admit it's outside the literal spirit of Westphalia, there is an argument to be made for it. Do they have a leg to stand on legally in that respect?
Well, you've raised a very good question, which people use, and the answer is that it's unacceptable, and sanctions can lead to situations which are worse than direct war. For example, the U.S. bombed Syria. Is it two or three times in April of several years, 2017, 2018, they bombed Syria, but the sanctions have reduced the living standards of Syria terribly. And I wonder whether the suffering of Syria under the sanctions, since they basically won their war against the jihadists, is there been more suffering by sanctions in Syria than there have by the jihadists. I don't have those figures, but Syrians are dying, and they died during COVID because they couldn't get enough medicine. So sanctions are an alternate to war for illegitimate purpose. It's a form of committing war against a country, generally of the global south. And so it's not a legitimate alternative. It's very important now to understand the change. Right now, the sanctions are not, have been shown to not be a very successful tool. And we can look at Russia, where the sanctions have not worked. The illegitimate sanctions against Russia have not worked because the Russian economy is booming and the U.S. banks are cracking up. And they even want, now, for example, they want to put sanctions against Hungary because Hungary is buying Russian oil. So, and Janet Yellen said yesterday that sanctions have undermined the dollar. And so the sanctions are now not particularly successful, but I think it would be premature to cry victory because the suffering, for example, in Cuba, the situation in Cuba is quite difficult. The suffering in Venezuela, which is palpable, the difficulties in Syria, Zimbabwe are really serious. I understand, and I don't even want to be quoted, but I understand that Iran is finding a way to bypass sanctions and do business. They have a huge internal market, so they may be escaping sanctions in part. But our duty as progressives in North America is to denounce the attempts by our governments to impose their will on the internal policies of countries whose policies are not in agreement with the United States. It's broadening up so much now because they're using them against Russia. They're probably going to use them against China. There's still some, there's a lot of economic measures against China, for example, chips and technology. I understand, and I'm not an expert on Chinese, anti-Chinese sanctions. I understand they're not succeeding and that China is probably going to go around them and find a way to bypass them. So,
well, yeah, it's not just Iran that's getting around them. I mean, the American countering America's adversaries through Sanctions Act, CATSA, is already focused on its allies in India, Turkey, and Pakistan, where it seems that they've made sure that Imran Khan won't be able to take power because he's seen as unfriendly. And this is all just related to Russia. And we've also seen that Germany is buying Russian oil, but it's just making a very circuitous route through third countries. So it's costing Germans a lot more. And there's a lot of collateral economic and humanitarian damage done to places that have nothing to do with this, like the African nations that haven't been able to get grain, for example, from Ukraine and from Russia itself. So a lot of people are hurt by this, to be sure. And Canada, John, and you and I are both Canadians, have taken up the cudgel with enthusiasm, a growing enthusiasm, where this country has sanctions now on a couple dozen countries, and it seems they seem to become more and more tool of first resort. John, we're fast out of time, but can you reiterate now that the schedule of, well, first of all, the book's rollout in Canada, because this book has been released in other places, and your role in it.
Fine. I'm a member of Sanctions Kill. I'm an author of one article in the book. We are having a meeting tonight in Hamilton at 7 p.m. We're having a meeting tomorrow night in Ottawa, and we're having a meeting on Friday night in Montreal. And we sent you the link to the live stream, which you can make available to your listeners, and you'll hear the meeting in the live stream in Montreal on Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern time.
Yeah, and that's tonight at the Michael Coffee Company in Hamilton at 7 p.m. For those of you in Hamilton, Ottawa, Thursday the 20th at 7 at Happy Goat, and Montreal at the Centre des Travailleurs Immigrants. That's terrible French. I apologize to everybody in Quebec for that. That's at 7 p.m. as well in Montreal. Well, John, I don't have in front of me the link to that live stream. Do you have it written in front of you?
I, Ken Stone just sent it to you by email.
Here it is. I've got it at tinyurl.com, Wrecking Ball Webinar. If you go to the HTTPS tinyurl.com/wreckingballwebinar, you'll find that, or search online the book title, Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy, and you'll find links, I'm sure, to other things. John, there's a ton more. I've got notes all over the place on stuff we didn't cover, including your article and the other articles that you co-wrote with some of the other fine people on here, and other stuff that I wanted to get to, but we don't have time today. But I thank you for
coming on
the show.
And, right? Let's keep this discussion of sanctions alive, and very nice to talk to you again.
Well, and especially in the Canadian context, where it's not talked about nearly enough. I want everyone else to stay here, because I'm going to go to Montreal to speak with Pablo Uziel and talk a little bit about what's going on in France and his native Spain after the break. Thanks again, John.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Escape the narrative. Guerrilla Radio. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, last week, France's constitutional court allowed some of President Emmanuel Macron's pension reforms, notably the most contentious one, an age eligibility rise. Organized labor there, who've rallied tens of thousands into the streets against the move over the last month, vows now to bring in a general strike on the workers' holiday, May Day. Meanwhile, Macron's address Monday was delivered to a cacophony of pots and pans, a regular casserolado banging outside the walls of power, where the workers chanted, "If Macron won't listen to us, we won't listen to him." Dr. Pablo Uziel is a postdoc at the Université de Québec à Montréal, whose area of study is the European Union, political, legal, and economic integration from above and below, and settler colonialism and Canadian society. His book, Democracy Here and Now, The Exemplary Case of Spain, chronicles the birth of the M15 movement against draconian government austerity measures and the rise of authoritarianism there and across the Western world. Pablo now divides his time between Montreal and his native Catalonia. Welcome back to the program, Pablo.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me here. It's always a pleasure.
Well, it's always my pleasure to speak with you. It's been too long already. I think almost half a year since we last spoke. So, Pablo, yes, Paris is burning. So the next incendiary question must be, I suppose, will the rest of Europe be set alight as well?
That's such a big question. But, I think my take on the current situation in Europe is that things are brewing. You know, disenchantment is brewing. I mean, it's been years of disenchantment brewing and certain movements appearing in different places at different times, all with similar demands for more democratic governments. So they're basically democratizing movements. And what we're seeing in France, it's interesting, right? Because we're talking about all these demonstrations and, you know, all these demonstrations happening after a new law is passed, which says that people who retire will have to retire at 64 instead of 62, which is 2 years more. And actually, if you look at the EU and you look at the retirement age, it's actually Greece and France, which have half the lowest retirement age as well. France has just changed that. So I think that it's not so much about the policy and how, but more about how it's been done, which shows kind of a response by elites in government in Europe. France is this the example we're looking at right now, but it shows how elites just don't really listen to people. No, I mean, Macron was asking 100 days of calm and unity, and as you pointed out, people are saying, "Well, Macron won't listen to us; we will not listen to him." There's this. I was just reading this morning about the man they call the French Spider-Man, who climbs up buildings. He just climbed up a 38-story building in Paris, and he said, "I'm here to tell Emmanuel Macron to come back to Earth by climbing with no safety net," which I thought was pretty indicative of the kind of response people have towards their politicians. So where is this heading in Europe? I mean, it will depend in a way on the deterioration of the economic situation in Europe. And we can talk more